It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. With an estimated 500 million fans and 10 million players worldwide, the popularity of rugby is on the rise, including here in the United States. The number of women participating in the sport is unprecedented, more than 2.7 million women players worldwide. World Rugby calls women's participation one of the sport's greatest success stories, representing the single greatest opportunity for growth in the next decade. Join in on the coaching philosophy that leads to success. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Derek Wagner coaches UW Eau Claire's Women's Rugby Club. Derek, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
UW Eau Claire Women's Rugby is a club sport governed by the National Collegiate Rugby instead of the NCAA. What does it mean to be a club sport?
Yeah, what it means to be a club sport, it's just, UW Eau Claire has our club sports that has, ultimate frisbee to soccer to softball to hockey. So a variety of different actual club sports compared to being like a D3 NCAA athlete. So what I like about it, it's a lot of, students who want to continue to be athletes who maybe played a ton of sports in high school that just want to continue on to playing sports in the school that they're going to.
And how long have you been personally involved in rugby? Have you played for a long time?
No, I actually started in college. So that would have been in 2009 is when I started playing for UW Stevens Point. A lot of people get to rugby in college just because they're aren't a lot of high school like opportunities. So it's really common to pick up the game in college. I played for 4 years at UW Stevens Point. And then right after that, I started coaching at UW Eau Claire for the women's club.
I have to wonder if you can just explain a little bit about rugby for people who are not familiar with the rules, because this is not something that we see. We don't see high school sports. We don't see it. It's not something that you see as often as those other sports. So tell us a little bit about the game and the rules. What's it like?
Yeah, for rugby, one thing I really like about it is it's a full contact sport. So for women, it's one of the only full contact sports that they can play that has the same rules as men. But the game itself, it's a lot of, obviously a lot of contact, but you only can pass the ball backwards. So that's fun. And when you get tackled, you have to release the ball and then try to what's called a ruck, try to regain possession of the ball. And then that's how it recycles from there. It's 2 40-minute halves. And you have 15 players on each team. So you have 30 players on one field at one time. And it can be a variety of different types of people as well. Like you're strong and strong players in your pack, as well as your backline players who are going to be a little bit more fast and run with the ball on the outside wings. So it's interesting that you can have a variety of different shapes and sizes and players in rugby on one team, but coordinating 15 players without any stops and it's continuous play is the fun part.
Sure. We're talking with Derek Wagner, who coaches UW Eau Claire Women's Rugby Club. Joining us now is Abby Jacobs. She is a UW Eau Claire student and women's rugby amateur athlete. Abby played for Team USA in the 2022 Garnet and Gold International Tournament. Abby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
You played both games for the women's U23 Team USA against Canada. What is a highlight from playing the games?
Oh, it was an awesome time. I would say a highlight would be like when you got the ball in your hands. It's like we worked so hard the building up days to it. And then like when you got the ball in your hands and I just like had so many coaches telling me things to do, and then like that was my time to execute it, and like just getting to like carry that ball or be that support for the other players, and like it was like little times in the game I feel like stuck out to me so much, because it was just like that's exactly what we talked about the week before and we've been working so hard for this, and things like that. So it was just, I would say like that would be a highlight for me. It was like executing the things we worked so hard on the week before and just seeing it come together.
Derek was talking with us a few minutes ago and said that he picked up rugby in college. He didn't play before then. What about you? You know, what drew you to it, and was it college for you as well?
Yeah, it was college for me as well. I had played three sports before I had joined rugby, like in high school. And those, I would say, like, by the time I got to college, I was a little burnt out. And I just was like, when I found rugby, it was so fun to learn a new sport and just like be on a team again, because I hadn't been on a team because I joined the second semester of my freshman year. So like, joining that semester, I just was like, I love the team, I love the people, I love getting the workout in, and I just loved learning a new sport. Like, it just all was, I just loved it. I fell in love pretty fast.
I can hear it in your voice, how enthusiastic you are. Derek, you have nearly a decade of experience coaching the UW-Eau Claire team. What's your coaching philosophy?
My coaching philosophy is to be like be there, right? I think dedication is so important, to be there all the time and communicate with the players appropriately. I think in my past, you know, I always want to be the coach that I always thought coaches should be, and being able to talk to players effectively, bring them up, be positive, and know how to talk to each player differently, because each person's going to be going through something different, so they're going to need different communication styles for them. So I try to bring really positive energy, but also just think about communication style for each player, each person, and how to go into each game so we can do our best. Everybody can play to their best. And, you know, at practices, it's I talk a lot about technique, how to do stuff, reasons why we do things, and try to ask a lot of questions so they can come up with the answers themselves and be able to understand reasons why we're doing things and how to do them.
Abbey World Rugby says more than a quarter of the entire rugby playing population is female, but let's face it, that means three quarters of the rugby population is male. So what is it like as a woman playing a sport that has a male dominated history?
I would say it's like, I don't know. That's interesting. I would say it's like when like you tell someone you play rugby, it's definitely like a reaction. And it's kind of fun, first of all, because I love spreading what rugby is. And like also spreading the idea that, like you had mentioned, like women can play it too. This is a full contact. You're going out on this field and you're going to come off hurting one way or another, you know? And I would say like, I'm not sure. It's just like being able to play that sport and be like, yeah, I can do hard things. I can do this. And I'm a woman. And like, I think that's awesome. And I guess that's kind of like how I would feel about that sort of thing.
Abby, you just said that when you tell people that you play rugby, you get a reaction. What do you see in people's faces?
It's just like, initially, sometimes it's that they don't know. Like in the States, you know, rugby is not as like watched as like overseas. I have some friends who I had played with, and they're like, literally every pub, every bar, that's what's on, because like that's so much more major over there. But sometimes it's they don't know, but I won't lie, most of the time it's like, wow, like you do that, like you you really do that. And it's also kind of like, I feel like it's a respect thing for people too. They're like, respect that you do that and that you're like tough enough or brave enough to go on that field and do it over and over.
Abby Jacobs is a UW-Eau Claire student. She is women's rugby amateur athlete. Abby played for Team USA in the 2022 Garnet and Gold International Tournament. Derek Wagner coaches UW-Eau Claire's women's rugby club. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our conversation about rugby's popularity. Join in on opportunities to get involved in this increasingly beloved sport 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Abby Jacobs is a UW Eau Claire student. She is a women's rugby amateur athlete who played for Team USA in the 2022 Garnet and Gold International Tournament. Derek Wagner coaches UW Eau Claire Women's Rugby Club. Derek, Eau Claire's season begins soon. What are your expectations this year?
Yeah, expectations wise, it's funny. Yesterday, NCR, the National Collegiate Rugby Conference that we're governed by, had us fourth in the preseason poll in the nation. So we're really excited about that and continuing to succeed throughout the year. So our goal is to win our conference, which we're part of the Great Waters Conference, which has 19 schools a part of it. So huge, huge conference in mostly in Wisconsin with all the UW schools, as well as in the UP and their schools in Illinois as well. So our conference kind of goes into those three states. But we're looking forward to trying to win our conference for the first time. So we're bringing back a lot of our team. We only missed one senior from last year. She was an All-American, but yeah, it's a big hole to fill, but it makes it much easier when you have so many players coming back. So expectations for this year is just continuing to learn, get new players in, but to look at our conference and try to go from there. Last year, we ended up eighth in the nation and we ended up losing in our conference final, but it was a fantastic journey last year and just hopefully can continue to build off of that.
Abby, what about you? Do you have any personal expectations or personal goals that you're looking to achieve this season?
Yeah, I would say, like, one thing that, like, I had thought about honestly the whole time I was at that USA camp was, like, how much of this I can bring back to, like, my home team. I love playing for Eau Claire, and we have so many young girls who are, like, going into their second year of playing, and the amount of knowledge I had learned, like, at that camp, I really would love to bring it back to our girls, and I feel like that can really help us take it to that next level where Dirk wants to win the conference. And, like, if we can just, like, I don't know, like, we're so young, if we can just kind of take that step and get into, like, a more mature playing, I think that would be really cool. Personal goals wise, I would say I want to be a leader in our forward pack, which is some of the bigger girls on the field, and just be like a driving leader out there and help bring people together for that. And yeah, honestly, more just like I want the best for the team this year. I think that we have a really good chance, but the only way to do it is like if we kind of all grow together, you know, and that's what I'm excited about as we go into this season. And I'm really excited for the season too. Like Derek had said, we only lost one senior. It's tough, but it's exciting to know how much returning players we have and what we're going to be able to do this season.
We're talking about rugby with Abby Jacobs, UW Eau Claire student athlete and former Team USA women's rugby player, and Derek Wagner, UW Eau Claire's women's rugby club coach. Derek, the role of coaches varies by sport, obviously. What is typically the role of rugby coaches during a game?
Yeah, during a game, I mean, it can be tough because there's no timeouts. So if I'm looking to do something or trying to set up something, it's really on their own. So for me, it's almost spectator, where I just have to sit and watch and make and see, you know, if what I tried to implement during the week, if it goes into Saturday. So it's watching, it's seeing where we can adjust. Thinking about halftime talk, thinking about what subs to bring in. But since it's so continuous, you know, I don't get a chance to call a specific play. It's more about the players on the pitch. And that's what makes it really more like about them, right? So they can make their own choices out there, and I can talk through those choices and talk to them about, you know, maybe we could have done this or that. But come game day, it's more about watching and seeing where we can adjust, but seeing the players implement the plan that we talked about throughout the week.
We have Rick from Wisconsin Dells on the phone. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Great, Great subject. Yeah, I'd like to just kind of reiterate that, you know, this is a great sport to continue athletics as a high school football player and wrestler. I didn't quite have the ability to do those things at the college level, but I still wanted to be involved in athletics. And I found rugby to be the perfect choice and a ton of fun and great exercise as well as camaraderie. And as far as the women's rugby, boy, the men really, really love it and respect the all the gals that are out there doing it. We think it's fantastic. So, yeah, I guess that's where I'm at. I think it's a fun game to watch, and it's an excellent game to play. So
thanks,
let's keep
Rick.
It going. Grow rugby. Go Rats.
All right. Thank you, Rick. Abby, Rick was saying that, you know, the men that play rugby really give women a lot of respect. Do you feel that?
I would say I feel that from a lot of people. Like when you meet someone out like in public and you just like mention that you play rugby or they figure it out and they also play rugby, there is that mutual respect like he was talking about. It's like, yeah, you know, that's part of the culture you're part of. And once you're in that culture, you're in that culture. And there is that mutual respect, which is really cool. And like, I would say the men know what we're going out there and we're doing. And yeah, you get that respect from them. And I think that's pretty cool. Respect for teams. Each club has a different culture to it. So some clubs you'll meet will be awesome and so supportive to the women's rugby and some aren't as supportive. But I would say for the most part, it's like you're in that community. And it's just like, wow, you're going out there and doing the same thing I am, you know, and there's that mutual respect. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Derek, what kinds of opportunities are there for people who want to get involved in rugby and give it a shot?
Yeah, I would say there's a lot more opportunities than you think. From middle school to high school rugby, and obviously in collegiate rugby as well as adult. So you can find them. You just got to look a little bit harder because sure. they are kind of few and far between. But especially within Madison area, Milwaukee, Green Bay has got a ton. Stevens Point, there's a ton of rugby to be had out there, and if there's not, start a club and research more about it because it can really be a great opportunity for the community to come in, both men, women. It's a fantastic way to continue to play, to be able to play and bring the sport and be able to grow the sport too. For me, that's one of the biggest things. I found rugby, I loved it. And my goal has always been to continue to grow the sport in different ways. And if we can get more youth players playing it and make it more of a normal to have, you know, high schools have the sport, then that's how we grow better players and can contribute to the US team. Because I mean, Abby's a prime example. She started in 2020 spring, obviously a tough time for everyone. She practiced for a full year. Her first fall was last fall, and then she was able to get on a pathway to the US team. So it is possible to be able to do that and to be able to contribute to a national team level in rugby.
We only have about a minute and a half left, but we have Rona from Camden on the phone. I want to make sure that we get her in. Hi, Rona.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, both of your guests. And I just want to say that rugby did a lot for my daughter. She attended UW-Madison and never played rugby except for in Fayette until she went to college. And I really watched her grow personally through the sport of rugby. It helped her develop some personal self-confidence, and she was able to take on leadership roles as captain, and I'm just really very thankful for it. She was never happy on a Saturday if it wasn't a rugby day.
That's great, Rona. And Abby, what did it do for your leadership skills? Did that translate for you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I had some leadership skills in my previous sports, and then coming into this takes you a little bit, like, to get to know the game, but, like, once you prove as like kind of a more dominant player out there, you know, it's like that respect from the girls gets there. And then like, it just like gives you the self-confidence to help lead them, you know? And it's like, the them trusting in you is what makes me want to lead them, you know. And it's like, it's so easy to, like, you know, shy off and not take that role sometimes, but like, there's so much support and everything. And it just, like, once I kind of found a leadership role, it was really fun to get to just, like, grow with it and just take that on confidence.
Abby and Derek, thank you so much for being here today and sharing that with us. Abby Jacobs, a UW Eau Claire student and women's rugby amateur athlete. She played for Team USA in the 2022 Garnet and Gold International Tournament. Derek Wagner coaches UW Eau Claire Women's Rugby Club. Ahead this hour, we'll explore Midwest food terminology with the host of PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Foodie. Join in, 800-642-1234. News, update, and a story from Wisconsin life are next. I'm Shereen Seward on the Ideas Network.
So, John, let's start with a simple question. What compelled you to write this book?
Several things. One was my own personal sense of adventure. I love going to wild places that few people have ever been to or go to now. I find a lot of joy in being in peaceful, quiet places. So that sense of adventure of just traveling around the state was enticing. And I really believe in the old statement of putting yourself in the way of grace. And that is really what happened in this 4 years of messing around all around northern Wisconsin. Put myself in the way of grace a lot, in the sense of coming to extraordinarily beautiful, peaceful places and trying to briefly be a part of those places. So there was that from a personal standpoint. And then from a writing standpoint, I wanted to do this because I really believe that the way we protect the natural world is through our love of places. We only protect what we love. We won't, you know, sit in front of bulldozers or write letters to Congress people or act in a way that can create change unless we really are passionate about things. So my hope is that getting people to some of these wild places will enhance and deepen their love of these places such that they will work to conserve them and potentially to try to entice the DNR to and the feds to purchase more wild lakes. So, because we really don't have that many. So,
Forgive me for thinking this, John, but your love of our wild lakes in Wisconsin comes through in your book. And I have to wonder if there is an unintended consequence that you could have these wild lakes may not be as wild as they used to be once they catch on.
Well, that's a legitimate concern. We are very capable of loving places to death, and we've seen that happen in many other places. You know, I would counter that, the opposite side of the coin being that my hope being the people will fall more deeply in love with the places by having visited them and will then work to conserve them. So maybe there's an inherent risk that some places may get more use than they have. I'm hoping that that use translates into better conservation, more political action, deeper love.
And one of the things you document in Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, John Bates, is, you know, how many people you see out there, how many tourists come out there, or how much portaging you have to do to get there in the first place.
Right. So a lot of these lakes, not too many people are going to be that crazy enough to portage into, to be honest. So I don't, and in fact, there were 10 lakes out of all that we went to, which was somewhere in a range of 138 lakes. There were 10 lakes we never even got to because we weren't willing to suffer enough to get to them. You know, you had to cross a half mile of bog or or the old road in was completely grown over, and it would have been a bushwhack of a quarter mile or more. So we left 10 lakes that I describe in there and say, you know, we never got there. Good luck.
You sure can. John Bates is a Wisconsin naturalist and author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, here on the Ideas Network. He's our guest. And let's take a step back for a second here, John, and because this debate comes up when we hear Minnesota and Wisconsin fighting over who has the most lakes, and this would go into John Bates' definition of a lake. How do you see a lake?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is said to have over 15,000 lakes. You need to temper that with the fact that over 6,000 of those lakes aren't even named. They're so small. My understanding is that those 15,000 the number comes from lakes 2.2 acres or larger. So those are, you know, what's the difference between a pond and a lake? Who knows? Minnesota defines lakes as anything larger than 10 acres. So one way or another, Minnesota wins the battle easily of having far more lakes than we do, based on defining the lake anyway as 10 acres or more, or even larger at 25 acres or more.
Well, in your experience, do you think that definition is fair? Because it sounds like there were a number of lakes that you traversed in your book that were smaller than 10 acres.
Well, there weren't actually.
Really?
All the lakes that I have in the book are 30 acres or larger. That was an arbitrary definition that I worked with, because to go to all of the smaller, really tiny pothole lakes the book would never have happened. I would have died. I'm 70 years old now. I don't think I would have made it. So you had to draw a line somewhere. I wanted to have lakes included that were large enough that if you put a kayak or canoe on, that you would have a paddle of, you know, at least 15, 20 minutes to go around the periphery of the lake. You know, a little 3 acre, 4 acre lake, there's not a whole lot of water. And so it was just an arbitrary definition that I used.
We have John Bates' definition of a lake. What do you consider a wild lake? Because there are some where you have tourists, there are some where you have fishermen, there are some where you have hunters. What's a wild lake to you?
Yeah. Well, again, an arbitrary definition on my part. So I used a number of criteria. One, the most important to me, was totally surrounded by public lands. So that all of these lakes, you will not see a single private home on. However, you may see a state or federal campground on it. So you might see a camper or something along a shoreline on some of these. You may see a dock into the water at a boat landing. And on a few of the lakes, in fact, there are either electric motors allowed, or on two or three of the lakes, motorboats are permitted. Nonetheless, they are completely undeveloped, publicly owned lakes, and thus are wild by my definition of non-privatized.
John Bates, our guest, naturalist and author of the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, give us some idea here of how our human ecology and modern technology has affected Wisconsin's lakes and their environs.
The very simple and obvious statement is that on a developed lake, you have less canopy cover along the shoreline, less shrub cover along the shoreline, and less understory cover, because people have spent a small fortune, the family jewels, to purchase a shoreline property, and they want to have a viewscape of that lake. And in doing so, in altering the shoreline vegetation, they alter the bird population, they alter the frog population along the shoreline by taking out woody debris along the shoreline, so they have more space for swimming and boating. They're altering the fish populations and aquatic insect populations. So there are consequences to our love of water and our development of water. So and there's consequences to the use of motorboats on water and stirring up sediments in shallow areas and wave erosions along shorelines. So these things are easily noted along developed lakes. And one of the differences, of course, in a wild lake is that shoreline is still wild. And that was one of the beautiful things that I really enjoyed. A number of lakes of, you know, going along these shorelines and seeing, for instance, trees that have fallen into the water, and they've been there so long, they've been colonized by mosses, and then the mosses have been colonized by bog plants, and you have this kind of a mini bog community.
Yeah, one of the places you detail this, John, is in Dry Lake in Vilas County, and they're these bryozoans. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're called. Yeah, they're moss animals. And they look like a giant brain, something from outer space. I've had many people over the years call me up and say, "What in God's name is this thing I just found in our
Found
lake?"
A brain.
Yeah, it's a big blob. It looks like a gelatinous mass, and it's kind of hard. But they're really odd, bizarre creatures. They're made up of this colony of things called zoids. You got to look at them under a microscope, and they have these little cilia, kind of hair-like tentacles that they extend out in the water, and they filter feed out of this blob. They're just bizarre and unique and really specific to cleaner water. So if you do have them, that speaks well for the quality of your water.
That was WPR's Lee Rayburn talking with naturalist John Bates on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us. I'm Shereen Siewert. A discussion on food is next on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Siewert. When I'm thirsty at the office, I head over to the bubbler. What is that? It's a drinking fountain, of course, if you live in the Midwest, or more specifically in Wisconsin. Though the internet is connecting people more and more, we all have unique vocabularies depending on where we live. This feels especially true when we're talking about food. What you call the foods you eat can say a lot about where you grew up or where you live now. Pancakes or flapjacks, a sub sandwich or a hoagie? Join in on this discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Luke Zahm is the owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua. He is host of Wisconsin Foodie that airs on PBS Wisconsin. Luke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you so much. We were having so much fun preparing for this show and looking at all of the fun food terms in Wisconsin that if you went anywhere else, they wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about. And you know, there was an article recently published by Eat This, Not That that lists some food terms you only hear in the Midwest. One of them is booyah. Can you explain for people who do not live in the Green Bay area? What is this dish?
Booyah! So booyah is it's a fish stew or a chicken stew. So I think it's Flemish, actually, in its origin. But specifically with chicken booyah, because I think that that's the most commonly accepted one. You know, you put together all these wonderful ingredients, and it almost has all the nuances of a delicious chicken noodle soup. But with the booyah, it's such a cultural tradition. I do believe the Green Bay minor league baseball team is the booyah, which is amazing. And it speaks to like the cultural tradition that has been impacted on European settlers coming into Wisconsin and bringing some of this old world food with them.
Well, we have to talk about one of Milwaukee's longtime traditions, the cannibal sandwich. Now, here in central Wisconsin, where I live, we call it Wildcat. But the cannibal sandwich is famous in Milwaukee. And in 2019, WPR spoke with two Milwaukeeans about this staple, Chef Justin Carlisle, one of the restaurant Arden, and Jeff Zupan of Bunzel's Meat Market. And I don't think
nobody wants to call them cannibal sandwiches.
Right.
The old timers do.
Right.
They come in and go, "I want some of the meat for cannibal sandwiches."
Right.
The other people are, "I'd like a steak tartare," or "I'd like this or that."
Luke, I thought we didn't have the audio there, but then we did. So have you ever eaten a cannibal sandwich?
Oh, heck yeah, girl. Of course. You know, like growing up, we did, because my mom's side of the family, very German, it would be like raw hamburger with salt and black pepper, and then we would do onions, mm-hmm. And then you'd put them on the rye cracker, which was, you know, pretty good. I remember that as a kid, like going up there, and of course you have this immediate shock of the raw meat, but it does. It comes from that idea of tartare. So we have, you know, at the best case scenario is we have delicious, freshly ground beef, And you said, you know, I would want to urge caution. Know who's grinding your beef. Know where it's coming from. Right. If you can do it yourself, all the better. But then, you know, it's really quite lovely. A lot of times if I'm taking apart a whole animal, I want to taste it in some capacity in its raw state, because that's when you really get a lot of the nuance of the fat. And you don't lose a lot of that original delicious flavor through cooking. So cannibal sandwiches are kind of like this ode to, you know, the raw. We're taking apart the animal. We're going to eat it right here. And specifically, Justin Carlisle at Ardent has, you know, kind of made its way in the industry with this amazing beef tartare that he makes with his father's beef. And it's delicious. If you haven't been to Ardent, it's worth a trip. Absolutely.
Midwesterners love a good hot dish. This is a type of casserole. What's your favorite kind to make?
Grub all day long. So grub was one of these pieces in college when I was going to school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My roommates and I, you know, obviously like haute cuisine is kind of off the table when you're living on a pretty fixed income and a tight budget. But this one had tater tots. It had the ground beef. It had the cream of mushroom soup. It had peas or green beans, frozen preferably, whichever one you could, and all the hot sauce you could muster. So you'd kind of bake it all together, and you get the tater tots nice and crispy on top, and then attack it with the hot sauce. And, you know, a good-sized pan of that would last maybe a day and a half in the house. It was great.
I think we all had that kind of hot dish when we were growing up, that favorite family hot dish. Another favorite Midwestern eat is a burger called the Juicy Lucy. Two bars in Minnesota claim to be the inventor of this. I think that's always up for debate. But what's the secret to making a good Juicy Lucy?
Well, first and foremost, don't look any farther than Wisconsin cheese. Minnesota can claim all they want, you know, and I mean, honestly, Minnesota's got to take their swagger where they can get it. I don't fault them for that at all. And if the Juicy Lucy's where it's at, fantastic. But for me, it's like two burgers where you put that cheese in the middle. And so you kind of pack that in really, really gently, and then you give it a really, really good cook. And once it kind of gets, you know, to the point where it smells like that meat's really starting to caramelize on the outside, you flip it, you do it again. And when you bite into that burger, all that cheese comes oozing out of the center. I don't know exactly how, like, you get the name Juicy Lucy out of that, but I know that it's delicious. And you know, I guess what's in a name?
We're talking about Midwest food terminology and the foods unique to Wisconsin with Luke Zahm. He is the host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS Wisconsin. The Midwest has its own food lingo, including with donuts. The Long John, a rectangular donut. I never knew that. People in other parts of the country didn't call it a Long John until like later in life. So what is that called outside of the Midwest?
I have no idea. I've always known them as Long John.
Yeah. They just call them donuts, I think.
Exactly. That's always been kind of the staple. Like, I remember growing up, like, you know, being able to go to the local bakery here in Viroqua and, you know, with your 25 cents, you could get a Long John. I don't know. Maybe there's something. Maybe we're missing out. But you know what? I kind of doubt it. What's your favorite frosting on a Long John?
Oh, it's got to be just the plain white icing. I like that the best. What about you?
Sprinkles? Do you do sprinkles?
I do. I do like sprinkles. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Awesome. I think I'm a maple. You know, the maple frosting type of thing. Like, it makes me feel like I'm eating something maybe a little more healthy for me.
Oh no. I can't do the maple. I can't do the maple. I love maple syrup, but I can't do maple frosting. How about dessert salads? This is a Midwest staple. You don't find these other places. Dessert and salad shouldn't go together, but they do so well. What do you picture about a decadent dessert salad?
My grandma used to make this thing, and my mom makes it now. And it's actually surprisingly complex. It's called 24-hour salad. And a couple years ago, like, my mom decided that nobody wanted to eat it at Thanksgiving or whatever holiday we were celebrating. And so she only made a small amount, like a quart of it. And there was almost a riot. This is like the 24-hour salad is pineapple. It's grapes cut in half. It's marshmallows. And then to make the actual dressing for it, which is kind of a misnomer, you make basically like a custard and then pour it over everything and you let it marinate for 24 hours. I mean, it's like the marshmallow, the fruit. It's super decadent. I do believe in other parts of the United States, they call it ambrosia, like in the Deep South. So we'd have to pronounce it a little different, like ambrosia. But it is also, you know, that dessert salad thing. My sister-in-law makes one with cranberry jello and celery and walnuts. Not my jam, personally, but, you know, it's definitely like if you've ever been to a Midwestern potluck, there's at least five or six of those dessert salads kind of in the corner, you know, talking at you while you're going through and getting all the hot dish you want, or maybe that, you know, shredded beef sandwich, or maybe it's a little risque and you've got that cannibal sandwich there, but you know you're going to go back for at least one, if not two, of those dessert salads.
Oh, you know it. In the Midwest, there's also this food term with two pronunciations, pasty and pasty. People mix them up sometimes. One is, you know, kind of a breast cover, obviously. The other is a baked pastry. So what do you know about this portable pie?
Portable pie. And I assume we're not talking about the breast covers.
Nope, we're not talking about that.
And here's the day we get censored on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I know. There goes my job.
So, I do believe pasties. Am I doing the right one here? Yes, pasties are like this, also kind of like Flemish. It's the same thing. It was taken into like the mines, I believe. Wisconsin actually has an illustrious mining history, specifically in the southwest corner, kind of by where I live. You know, you're talking Platteville. You're talking about Mineral Point. And so the Flemish miners would take them into the mines with them. And it was kind of like this bread and you've got, you know, kind of whatever you want in the middle. Some people like it, you know, with the tomato and maybe a little pepperoni, but like, I think the OG ones are beef and potato and carrot, and you put it all in this sealed pastry pocket. And, it's like the OG hot pocket, so to speak.
Exactly.
I know that in West Virginia, they do pepperoni rolls, which are the same thing. Like the coal miners would take them down into the mines. And it was food that would keep well, and, you know, you could have that little bit of comfort.
I love it. Luke, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate this fun discussion on a Friday.
Hey, I appreciate you guys. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. Luke Zahn, the owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua and host of Wisconsin Foodie. On PBS Wisconsin, just ahead, natural disasters negatively impact socially vulnerable populations. A UW Oshkosh researcher explains how Wisconsin can better respond to emergencies, including natural disasters and deadly viruses. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.